Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hi, and welcome to Everything is Fine, a podcast for women over 40. I am one of your hosts, Jen Romolini. Our other host is Kim France. And this week, we're going to do something a little different. Kim had some travel snafus, so I conducted the interview with our guest today, Sloane Crosley, by myself. Hope you enjoy it. Sloane has a new book coming out this week called Grief is for People, which we really loved a lot. And I love Sloane. And it's an interesting conversation about grieving a friend and about growing older. And anyway, I missed Kim a lot. I hope you like it. Kim will be back next week. Thanks so much. Our guest today is Sloane Crosley. Sloane is the author of the novels Cult Classic and The Clasp, as well as three essay collections, including the New York Times bestsellers I Was Told There'd Be Cake and How Did You Get This Number? Her latest book, Grief is for People, is out now. Welcome, Sloane.
Welcome to you. No, just kidding. This is a joy. It's such a joy to see you, to speak with you. Very happy to be here.
Same. Just full disclosure for listeners, Sloane and I go back a long time and have not seen each other in, I can't calculate.
I'm going to guess the single digit century time. So I think it would be too. Like actually maybe 2009, 2008.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there was a restaurant I remember going to where everybody went in the West Village. I cannot remember the name of it, but it had a spotted pig.
Spotted pig.
That might be the last time we were together.
Oh, wow. That's a that has sort of a scandalous tentacles that reference, because I think that the third room of the Spotted Pig is what brought the Spotted Pig down, the activities that took place there.
Yeah. It became, but at that time, who knew? Who knew? We're also going to like the lit bar that was owned by, what was this?
Lit
Sebastian
Lounge.
Younger? No, but also Sebastian Younger had one. Yeah. Like, remember that?
The Half King.
Yes, the Half King.
The Half King had that reading series that was so good.
Spent a lot of time in there. It wasn't
I'm like, I'm like, gather around, children, a bar with a reading series.
the old New York Times. Yes. All right. Well, listen. We're laughing.
Good to
now.
See you.
It's good to see you. But we're going to talk about your book, which is sad.
It's sad. Well, it's funny too, but it is the main theme is not joy necessarily.
I loved your book. I just want to say it. I loved it. I thought it was really smart. I thought it was really well paced. I thought it said things that I have not heard about grief and about friendship and about all kinds of things. And I thought you did it in a really clever way, and it was very sneaky in ways, you know, like you snuck some things in. I really, really liked it. It's a great book.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. So this recent book is about loss and grief, specifically about the loss of one of your closest friends to suicide. And I just want to ask you, like, how are you doing talking about this and having to be on a book tour about this very tender and painful topic? Hi.
That is a considerate question, which sounds like a politician's response. I'm so happy you asked that, Jean. That's not your name. I figure out what to say. I think, you know, there's an old Capote quote where he says you should, I'm instantly going to butcher another writer's quote. It's a great way to start this off. But something about how all your tears should be dry before you set pen to paper. And I, not to disagree with the master, but I feel like you have to have some crumpled tissues nearby. Do you know? So I feel like the same thing is true of the promotion of the book, where mostly it's fine. Mostly the anxiety I experience is the same book anxiety I would experience if I wrote a book about like the history of pineapple farming in the United States. But you know, who's going to cover it? What are they going to say? Blah, blah, blah. But I feel like every once in a while, someone will ask me something that sort of pierces the veil. And I just, it's so trippy that this even still happened. You know, the book is structured around, loosely around the five stages of grief, which are loose in and of themselves. But sometimes I feel like my version of grief, you know, like it's a perfume, it smells different on everyone. My version of it is to sometimes really be sort of still stuck in denial, still convinced that my friend had a bad oyster and is in the bathroom. Do you know what I mean? Like in a genuine way. And so I feel this sort of disconnect with all the emotions I went through because I wrote the lion's share of it over the pandemic. Now it's like I'm touching back down into it, but not in a psychologically dangerous way, because the truth is I love talking about him and I'm proud of the book. So that sort of keeps me from, I guess, having a nervous breakdown.
Yes. Let's talk about him. Who was he? Who was he to you? Let's talk about him for a second.
So basically, should I do the overarching thing of the book? Like the whole
plot? Do the whole thing. Yeah.
Okay. So page one. How long is this podcast?
As long as we want.
As long as we want. Okay. So basically what happened was in late June of 2019, I left my home for 1 hour and came back. I was just doing errands and came back and all my jewelry was gone and I had been burglarized. Someone had broken in. Their muddy boot prints were on my bed, which on a side note, like not a very good thief. Why am I seeing boot prints? It just occurred to me just now. But I'm like, wow, that guy didn't have a lot of skills. But he did make off with every piece of jewelry I'd ever been left by my grandmother or great-grandmother. It was not good. And then
it was a collection. It was a collection.
It was a collection, but it was also not a collection. Part of the mystery, the book is about, you know, several interlocking mysteries. One, which we've already discussed, is coming, which will be a lot bigger than the burglary. But I don't walk around, you know, I'm not like King Kardashian. No one's going to like break into my hotel room in Paris. Like there's no reason really.
Right.
So
right. For your diamond grill. Right.
Yeah. To find out. Exactly. Well, obviously that. Sure.
Maybe.
But anyway, so one of the people trying to help me solve this mystery or a person who I was really leaning on was my former boss at Vintage Books, where I worked for almost a decade as a publicist at Random House, was my former boss, Russell Perot. And we were extremely close. I mean, the way I describe us in the book is people who sort of swap positions as they do in experimental theater. We're like, someone's the husband, someone's the boyfriend, someone's the brother, someone's the annoying friend, you know, like we were just extremely, extremely close, like a real partnership of a friendship. And I adored him very much. And, he was like, you know, part of the skyline for me.
Yeah.
And about a month after the burglary, we were having dinner. You know, he was supposed to cat sit for me. We were having dinner. And that was his sort of payment for the cat sitting, was me buying him a lobster roll. And then he hugged me and I was so upset about the jewelry. And his last words that he ever said to me when he hugged me were, "Well, if it's any consolation, you can't take it with you when you go." And then 3 days later, he died by suicide at his house in Connecticut. And that's, needless to say, where we really enter the Thunderdome of grief.
Yeah.
So the burglary becomes intertwined as sort of a symbol of loss and of these of the unknown and the frustration and wanting to stop the kind of bleed of loss. But really, the book is about him, his death. And part of the reason I wrote the book is it's such a tribute to the people that I think you and I kind of know, the behind-the-scenes people in the arts. And it's a tribute to our friendship. And then hopefully in that detail, it becomes something that other people can relate to, which is the point of writing.
Yeah, but, of course. Yeah.
But he was a wonderful, irreverent, generous, highly energetic, brilliant, wildly inappropriate person.
Yes. And yes. And that's what I got from the book. And also the kind of person that used to be, there used to be a lot of them in New York. Mm-hmm. That's why we moved.
Because yes. He wasn't alone. He wasn't like Falco the owl or whatever.
That's right. Right. Exactly. Right. Exactly. Like, and I think that, I don't know, because I haven't been in New York in a while, but I do feel like there are fewer and fewer Russells in the world, like yes. The kind of boss who not like being inappropriate where you feel like it's, you know, it's just saying it like it is, like that's sort of very direct.
No, just kind not of, worried. Yeah. No, yes. He was never, I should say, he wasn't the kind of person who would, you know, it's not lording sex over people in order for them to get promotions. He's not, it's nothing like that, but he might say something that, I mean, really, I hopefully I paint him in all his glory, which is to say that I also paint his flaws. And he would say things at some point. My assistant walked into a meeting and she wore like very preppy but form-fitting clothes, like out of the 50s or something like that. And she walked in with this cardigan that had some like very overworked buttons down the middle. And he looked it up at her and it was like in no time at all. He was just so sharp. He looked at her and he said, "Oh my God, it's like you walked into Talbot's and said, give me the sluttiest thing you have." And I was like, "Oh no." Right, and I remember pulling her over sort of after the meeting and say, "You know, he's very funny, but if he ever says anything that bothers you, I hope you'll let me know." And this is before the Me Too. This is before anything. And she was like, "No, it's fine." He had just finished sort of fighting for her raise. So there was an acceptance of this kind of a person who was not poisonous, who was not nefarious, who was not also like kind of beating a younger generation over the head with being from an older generation. It was just, but I do think he got swept up in the rules that we needed that came after Me Too.
Yeah. Yeah. But just that sort of like, people don't talk to each other in that way anymore. No. That's not the way we talk to each other.
Yes. Yeah. Do you think personally, I still have friendships where there's a bluntness.
Yes.
But even then, I think also we've all become just, maybe it's a post-pandemic thing. It's always easy to blame the pandemic in terms of why we're so sensitive now. I don't know.
Yeah. People aren't as blunt as they used to be, I think, for sure. But anyway, I enjoyed seeing him. I knew him. I understood him. Was this your first experience with grief at this scale?
Oh, wow. I would say it's my first experience with this brand of grief. Okay. Both my parents are luckily, knock on wood, in decent health and alive right now. So is my immediate family. I've had friends die. Actually, friends we have in common, I think. But I've never known anyone who died by suicide. I was in a wedding right after college graduation, and I walked, I was sort of paired with a brother of the groom who I had never met. And I remember I walked up the, aisle with this stranger, as part of the wedding. And then 2 days later, he had died of like a heroin overdose. And I remember thinking that's so strange that I have had this strange Venn diagram, this tiny little bit of overlap of touching some sort of veil. The fact that I'm even bringing that up only highlights how much the answer is no. I've never had loss of this scale or this type. It's really the type. Yeah. I just haven't known anyone who's died by suicide like this.
And the immediacy of that. It's just so, so, it's
have you?
So abrupt. I have really, my parents were teenagers when they had me and they're, also in good health. And I haven't, and I'm stealing myself for it because I'm going to be 51 years old next month and this month. And like, I am like, this is all coming for me. And I haven't really experienced grief at that level yet. The loss of a parent, the loss of a sibling. I've had friends who I've lost, and it is profound, but it's not that primal kind of relationship. So anyway, so I think about that a lot, because we've talked a lot about grief on this show, and I do think it's something you should write about right away. I've had friends who wrote grief memoirs, and I do think, because I think that you're so in it and it's so specific, that I think that the rule does not apply to this pain, because I think you need to capture it.
Well, I think that's true also because your non-writer inclination as a human being is, you know, not to forget, but to heal, right? Is to like put it somewhere. Which is not always conducive to explaining what it's like. Do you know, the inclination is to like get through it, not to like retell the story again and again, as you would, let's say, an essay about a breakup or something like that. And it's to somehow figure out how to digest it. But I feel like when you talk about the preparation, I think about that too. You know, I've started to have these conversations with my sister and about our parents, and not that there's anything wrong, and the conversations are very light for now, where, you know, do you know what they're doing about this? No, do you? Okay, well, I guess I'll see you for dinner at 8. You know, they're not. They're
what
still
are their finances?
There. Yeah, like what? I don't know. Well, they're out there somewhere. We'll find out, huh? But I don't think this is going to be like Knives Out. What? Yeah, you know, there's not going to be a surprise inheritance that I don't know about.
Right.
But it's more like, but with this, what it does do is start bracing you for the surprise, for the things for which you cannot plan, which is different. And I try to, you know, I touch on that a little bit in the book, that, you know, a sudden loss versus a loss that you prepare for, they both, neither are great.
Yeah.
But there is that extra layer of frustration with a sudden loss that doesn't have to be suicide. It could be an accident. That is just a real, you just sort of – the math has sort of worked backwards instead of forward. So instead of preparing for, you know, what's it going to be like to be untethered and walking this world without my parents, and that has nothing to do with me being close to them or not. Just simply it's almost like suddenly you came from nowhere. It's so strange. So that's sort of math you're working forwards, but a suicide, a tragic accident. I think these things work backwards, and you start thinking of the last time you saw them or what led to it, you know.
It's almost like forensics. It becomes it's so fast that it's a mystery, right? It's a mystery. It's a mystery. And like, could I have changed something? And could I have?
But the thing is with the suicide, I really try to, like, part of the point of the book is to be like, I don't think I could have. I think there's everything is, you know, everyone's a special snowflake in terms of how they die. So, but I don't feel so there are ways that if this is someone who is struggling with going on and off medication and therapy, and that I could have intervened with that, sure, I guess I might have a little, an extra layer of guilt that's sort of like a patina on how I feel. Yeah. But like, I feel like it's almost like a weird hubris-y question when people say, you know, oh, did you know?
Yes.
Or like, oh, is there anything I could have done? And I'm like, I personally, me, like I'm a superhero. I'm going to stop a 52-year-old cogent man with no history of being in therapy from, what, am I going to tie him to a radiator? Like, I can't. So I feel like there's a weird thing where I'm like, no, I don't actually think that I can do everything is really the answer to those questions.
100%. And I think that we think about these things in the wrong way. And there's also like an unknowableness to all of us, right? There's just like, there's only so much we actually know each other. And that's, I think that's one of the hardest things for people to wrap their head around, you know, like, oh, well, we're close, but we're this, but we're, it's like, we're unknowable to each other ultimately.
Yes. Yes. It's really, and it's actually kind of amazing. What is the, there's a, I'm going to mess it up, but is it a Zeno's paradox? Is that the thing? Do you know what
I'm going to get
about?
It. I'm going to get it wrong.
Okay. It's basically that thing, which is, this is, obviously I was not a physics major, but basically you can never actually touch something because everything is always sort of divided by itself constantly. And so like you'll never, two points will almost ever never actually reach each other.
Yeah.
So that's my poor physics analogy for what you're saying.
No, it's a great analogy. No, there's a part in the book where you write, no one is obliged to learn something from loss. This is a horrible thing we do to the newly stricken, encouraging them to remember the good times while they're still in the fetal position, like feeding steak to a baby. I mean, that line is incredible. But
thanks.
What else did you find like that we get wrong when we're trying to comfort those who are grieving? Because there's some anger in this book. You're pissed. You're like, what the fuck are these books and everything?
I am
like,
so happy you said that. Yeah. I'm happy you said it because I think, you know, it's divided, and then I'll answer your question, but it's divided roughly in these five parts, right? So it's not essays. It's actually linked in these five chapters. And so much of the anger section is about never – of wanting it, being like, okay, I'm ready. You know, not that the stages are so definite, but that I'm ready to at some point experience anger, but saying, you know, I'm not even going to know it's about him when it arrives. And I feel like I'm angry at everyone else who's not him.
Yes.
And I'm like, where's the anger? Where's the anger? And then only when I finish the book, I'm like, oh, the whole book is angry.
The whole book is angry.
I'm really pissed.
The whole book is angry. And I'm like, angry. This is great.
I'm royally pissed. I'm pissed that this person who I love so much didn't get an obituary. And so I feel like I joke around, but it's real. I'm like, I got 200 pages worth of real mad that he didn't get an obituary. But I feel like one of the things to remember that I was shocked within myself, people were so nice to me. You know, people say idiotic things because they're trying and failing, but you can't police them too much, right?
Right.
They're just trying to help. And unfortunately, sometimes when bad things happen, whether it's a burglary, a breakup, a death, whatever it is, unfortunately, we still have to work within the confines of the English language. And so all the trite things that we've used to express pity or sorrow, empathy for when someone loses their job, like, or, you know, I'm sorry for your loss. Oh, that sucks. I'm so, you know, that's terrible. What can I do?
Yeah.
Get applied to this. It's like, that's my name. You'll wear it out. And now there's no language almost left for when something truly horrific has happened. And the thing, this sounds so negative, but a big part of the thing that I had to learn or realized about myself is that I think a grieving person, they need you, but they are not to be trusted. And the reason why is because if someone is really hurting and misses someone so much, I feel like these lovely people who are trying to be there for me, who are my dear friends, it's a kind of insanity where I thought, you know, I would throw any of you into the street and over a cliff to get my friend back. Oh. It's this horrible feeling of like, I'm like, you're just, you have all, no matter what you say, you have committed the crime of not being able to bring him back. Why are you here? You know, this horrible sort of inability to accept condolences in that way. Because I'm like just feeling like you don't know what you're talking about. Even though there's that great now I will hopefully get this right. There's that James Baldwin quote where he says, you think your pain and your heartbreak are unprecedented in the history of the world. And then you read.
Yeah.
You know, you're not alone.
No.
But it's just this like – so I think what I would say is that like to me it's like declarative sentences. Especially there's a sort of macabre curiosity about suicide, where people are like, just instantly the knee-jerk response is, did you know? You know, had he been sick? How did you? Da-da-da. And people, and I'm like, don't just say you wish you knew him. Say you're sorry for my loss. And even maybe just point out how I think it's so easy to just be like, I know there's no other language, but I am really sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that it's like, we're so curious because it's like an infection we think we can catch. And we're like,
how to use your story. But I'm like, I can't believe you're trying to use, like, I'm not raw material for you right now, even though I know you're scared about yourself and your own friends.
Let's take a quick break from some ads.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Support for Everything is Fine comes from Ritual. So I love Ritual. Everyone knows I love Ritual. I talk about Ritual all the time. I particularly love its daily multivitamin. And I also really have been enjoying their melatonin. But the thing I love most about Ritual is their Hyacera. It's a once daily skin supplement that's clinically proven to reduce wrinkles and fine lines and increase skin smoothness in 90 days. In a clinical study, Hyacera led to 3.6 times reduction in crow's feet wrinkles within 90 days as compared to a placebo. Hyacera led to 2.9 times increase in skin smoothness within 90 days as compared to a placebo. You can enhance your skincare routine from the inside out with one daily capsule essenced with soothing vanilla. I love Hyacera. It's been rigorously tested and validated. It's one of the industry leading sustainability. It meets all of the industry leading sustainability standards. You know, I'm a beauty editor now. I am all about keeping my face plump. And Hyacera absolutely has done that for me. I've been on it for months. I don't even know how long. And I can really see a difference in the texture of my skin. My skin looks more juicy, I guess is the best way to do it. Say it, do it. Okay, so you can start Hyacera to help minimize wrinkles without compromising on clean science. Hyacera from Ritual is a clinically proven skin supplement you can actually trust. Get 25% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/fine. Start Ritual or add Hyacera to your subscription to get today. That's ritual.com/fine for 25% off. And we're back. You write fiction as well. What were the challenges switching to memoir? I mean, what was like that? Was it a challenge? Was it anything? That's such like a writer question. But like, was it? I'm just curious because this is a painful topic and like you're now writing as yourself, right?
Yeah. I mean, you're always writing as yourself, right? It's just, but I think, you know, they say every character in fiction is a version, you know, of the writer, which is, you know, scary in the case of Lolita, but the point is that I feel like, so I had handed in, I had finished pretty much the last draft of Cult Classic, my last book, when Russell died. So I had handed, I mean, I had changes to make to it, but I had handed that in what I consider the first day of the pandemic, March 1st, 2020. I handed
a
book and I'm like, okay, have fun publishing this. Like, we don't know if there's gonna be publishing houses or zombies or paper shortages. I'm like, I just feel like, well, this is sort of dumb, but here's a book.
Right.
And then I sort of started, and because the whole world had switched frequencies
That's
pandemic,
nice. Yeah,
you know, I feel like this book that, you know, we have in our hands now, Grief is for People, really matched the frequency of death being everywhere and me working alone in my apartment during the pandemic. And you could argue that, like, one never knows what to do. Like, does working on a depressing book during a depressing time make it worse? I mean, honestly, I made myself laugh as much as I made myself cry. It's like, cats. Yeah. In the book. Well, because like he's a very, very funny person who died, you know? Like, I'm not mourning a schmuck, you know?
No,
like you've got, or like a drip or whatever, you know?
It's right.
So, but it wasn't like, I'm sort of used to it because I wrote two books of essays, then a novel, then a book of essays, then a novel, then this.
Yeah.
So I've actually been on the every other one track for a little while.
Okay. Yeah. Hopping back and forth.
Yeah.
In terms of the anger,
You're like, let's get back to your anger issues.
Well, no, because I think that I found it very refreshing, and I like seeing angry women. I think that we're very uncomfortable with angry women, but I wonder.
Also, it takes one to not that you're angry, but to pick up on it. You're the first person who's been like, "It's an angry book." I'm like, "Thank you."
Yeah, thank you. You're pissed. Did you think about depicting yourself as a character in the story? Did you think about like, am I going to be unlikable? Am I a character? Am I an angry character?
God, man, I've given up feeling worried about likability. Sometime, maybe about sometime around the last time I saw you, sometime around 2009.
Okay, good.
I mean, it's not entirely true. Like fundamentally, the way I write, especially when it comes to narrative nonfiction, is I do think you actually are obliged to entertain people.
Yes.
In this case, that means depressing them or pulling at their heartstrings. But that's a form of entertainment. I don't think just the confessional writing, sort of confessing for the sake of it. I think it's like a monkey with a typewriter. Occasionally you will type Shakespeare doing that. But for the most part, it's just sort of blather. So for me, there has to be some structure where I'm concerned about if I'm so unlikable that people stop reading, then I care a lot. But I don't feel on a sort of micro level, I suppose, worried, oh, is that an unlikable line? Is that a weird thing I just did? Am I alienating? Do people think I'm a snob? That's the biggest thing when you're writing and you live in a city is everyone else thinks you're a snob.
Yeah. Oh, totally.
Because you're using proper names. I mean, it's funny if you do a deep dive about some of the reviews for the Year of Magical Thinking, they're like, what's up with all the proper nouns?
Wow.
You know? Yeah. They're like, oh, it's just, you know, so, and even I mentioned in my book, even I am not immune to that. Like at some point I talk about remembering this detail from the Year of Magical Thinking after Russell died, where Joan Didion talks about shortly after John dies, Julia Child dies. And, you know, she uses as a sort of bullet point to her crazy state to say, she uses this incident to say, oh, good, now John and Julia can have dinner together in heaven. And I know she was trying to say, hey, look how crazy I am. But what I took away from that is you're friends with Julia Child. So, like, I'm not immune to that. But at a certain point, if you're going to shy away from the facts of your life or from the sort of nuances of your personality to that much of a degree, I don't know why you're writing. To do something else then if you're worried. If you're worried about it. Go open a restaurant. That's hard enough.
Okay. That's okay. Exactly. That'll be as hard.
Yeah. It seems pretty hard to me.
Exactly. That'll be as bad as writing, maybe worse. If you're a self-flagellating masochist, it'll be good. So there, you know, forgive me and excuse me, but I'm going to read two lines from your book because this is kind of taps into another thing that I think this book is about. I think this book is angry, but I also think this book is about performance of self.
Mm.
Okay.
So
you write of Russell, your friend. He is my favorite person, the one who somehow sees me both as I want to be seen and as I actually am. And there are a lot of sneaky sentences in this book that nod at a performance of self, I think. And later in the book, you write that Russell's addiction to performance served not only as a supplement to life, but too often a replacement for a story of his own.
Yes.
And I wonder if there's something in this book that's also a midlife reckoning. Because you're in your 40s. Russell was in his 50s. This is a time where we start reckoning with the performance of self, right?
I agree. And sort of I'm not facing nodding. Ourselves. I shouldn't do that on a podcast.
That's okay. And facing ourselves down. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you, how you thought about the performance of self and how you wrestled with it in writing this memoir, his performance of self, yours, you know, how they interacted, if you thought about that at all.
I did. And I think it can be so isolating because the you think, as he thought, you think of yourself as genuine, I hope. I mean, I think even the most full of shit people don't walk around being like, wow, I'm really full of shit. I mean, it would take,
right?
You know, it's funny what other people can pick up in the coffee shop you're going to need a therapist to tell you, you know. But I feel like I do think he wrestled with that, and I think it isolated him because I think the world around him, specifically his work world and the media world, mm-hmm. And socially what happens in middle age is you have your people who can tolerate you and who you can tolerate, where you just sort of grow like bonsais around each other and you're with these completely warped trunks that are essentially unsuitable when you take them out. Because if you've ever been in a situation where, let's say you tomorrow, you have lovely wallpaper behind you, and let's say I had to send you to a wallpaper convention in Vegas where you didn't know anybody and you had to make a bunch of friends and like break off into teams. What a living nightmare to have to like have no shorthand with anyone else, you know, and to sort of cut your teeth or sort of prove yourself and hone your skills from scratch. And so I think we think of ourselves as just sort of open and genuine. And then as you get older, if you're ever put into a situation where people don't give you the benefit of the doubt, you're like, oh, wow, I'm really rusty at this.
Yes.
It's like reality television where you see those like, you know, one-on-one interviews where there's someone tearful being like, I'm really well liked at home. You know? No one has ever described me as a little much. And like all of middle age feels like that.
Right. Well, it's because it's like things become kind of fixed. It's
yes.
Not as
and
fluid.
He struggled with it because his story, when I talk about the storytelling, it's like, you know, this is someone who promoted stories for a living, and they became these almost like symbols or talismans of who he was. He was made up of his references, as a lot of us are. But I think no one questioned it with him because the references weren't 80s movies, you know, where you're like, get a personality beyond this. You know, they're books, they're Shakespeare, they're Sondheim. Who's going to say, like, get a better interest?
Right. Right.
So,
and who's going to poke underneath? Because when somebody is charming and smart and engaging, it is almost like a mask because you're not going to poke around and be like, well, what do you think? What do you really think about that? What's your internal life? We don't, that's not the way we engage. Even in some of our most intimate friendships, it's not necessarily how we engage with each other.
Well, also, I think you start slotting people. It's so funny. It's like, I feel like you learn everything you need to know about life when you're like in third grade with all the aphorisms, you know, where they're like, oh, don't judge a book by its cover. For grief, you know, the only way out is through, like all this stuff.
Yeah.
And then there's like a really long period of time for decades where you're like, oh, I get it. And I've applied all these things really successfully. And then it's like, we get tired. I'm just tired of using it. And now, I probably judge more people by their covers than I did like 10 years ago. I'm like, ah, this old chestnut.
Yes.
And Russell would slot it into like, unfortunately, like Tosca or Carmen, but it's the same thing, you know?
Yeah.
He'd meet somebody and be like, oh, you're this kind of person. This is how the world will treat you.
Yes. You know? We're less open. We start getting
less
closed.
Open. He was still joyful though, because like you're saying, that the charm and the joy will cover that up. But he was pretty, I guess it's judgment. I don't know.
Well, because our interests become narrower because we feel like we've seen it all. We've done it all.
Yes.
And when at the time when we really need to become more open and start like redefining who we are. It's a very – midlife is – it's
– Well, also you're not dead yet. I mean, I feel like this idea of like you're going to – you know, obviously we're talking about someone who – died before his time, or her decided that his time was then. I disagree. As does everyone who loved him. But, you know, aside from those terrible instances that we've been talking about, you're going to live a long time. And you have to figure out how to renew yourself again and again within those, you know, without feeling like you're starting from scratch. You know.
And sometimes you can start from scratch. Like, that's the thing. I mean, that's the thing we talk about on this podcast a lot. If you're not happy with what you're doing, like, you can start from scratch. You're not, your brain still
works. It just
works.
Takes more. It just takes more. It's more impressive. It's just more impressive. When I hear about, you know, for as a writer, there's like, I'm now going to get them wrong, but I used to have like a sort of running list in my mind of being like, you know, Toni Morrison published her first book when she was like 42.
That's right, know, right,
like,
right.
Like
right.
a running list, you know? Right, and then right. there's certain other people you ignore, like Keats, who was dead by 26. you know, that person we don't talk about. Michelangelo, I think 25, he can jump in a lake. But we, like, but you know, you keep a running list of the people who, Gauguin, start over.
Yeah.
Start over.
But it is that idea, because it can be so overwhelming when the slot that you've been in and the place you've been in is changing around you and you don't really fit anywhere anymore. Then it is like, oh, I have to remove myself. I have to not allow this to keep, I just need to keep renewing, and I need to let my ego go to the wayside, which is kind of the impossibility of the whole thing.
And well, speaking of ego, I'm going to say something kind of gross, but one of the blurbs was that I actually sort of learned something from, because, you know, you don't see yourself in the mirror exactly as you are, you know, until someone else sort of comes in and, you know, before the reviews, the blurbs come ideally. And one of them was from John Mulaney, which was wonderful. But it was his. It's so funny because it was just in a blurb. It wasn't like I don't think he meant it as a deep thing. I think he thought I already knew it. He said it's something like about the pain of watching someone fit less and less in the world. And I'm like, oh, that is what the book is about. And I hadn't really noticed it. Because so much of when you're writing a book like this, which I hope I never have to do again, but of this, you know, it's not in the marketing materials because it feels very, speaking of the early aughts, but you know, if it's technically a year, I just didn't want to do like my year of loss, but right. technically from the burglary to COVID is really a year. Okay. And for those, it's so funny. I almost always want to issue more of a warning to people about the COVIDness of the book than the suicide. Cause I think people are so sick of reading about COVID. I'm like, don't worry. It's not that long, but John saying, you know, I hadn't really noticed it was a year of grief. And I also hadn't really noticed that it was about, it's about watching someone fit less and less in the world. It's just, to me, it's just sort of what happened to my friend, you know?
Yeah.
But I do think people can relate to that.
But how did it change how you think about fitting in the world, or didn't it?
I feel like I worry about it. I worry about it a lot, because I feel like I think that I was thinking sort of abstractly before I got on the phone Zoom with you about this podcast and about I'm going to be gross and now quote myself again. But there's a bit where I say that, you know, I found myself at an age where I struggle because I find myself at an age where one wants to take credit for one's experience, but also wants to swallow one's experience in conversation, lest one reveal one was around to witness the Pleistocene, you know? So like it's all cute, and not only cute rather, but impressive and ambitious to, you know, be like, I had an assistant by this age. I was doing this at this age, you know, consider me a grown up. Yeah. And this weird mental price you pay for that later, which I'm not suggesting you shouldn't be ambitious. I mean, it's the best thing you can be, but I just feel like the mental price later is to almost tack years on because you had a big life really early on.
Yes.
And so then when it's later, you're like, oh my God, I was there the last night of that club. I wrote for that magazine. Do you know, I was an intern. Ready? I'm gonna blow everyone's doors off. I was an intern at Mirabella. You know?
You're blowing my doors off. Yes.
Yeah. Well, the truth is it was the last summer it existed. So that's the part that's silent. So, you know, it is actually, you know, I'm on the line. And I'm sure a lot of people my age feel that way. And it's like, so I feel like for me, in terms of how I operate, I feel like I do worry about becoming disconnected. Like, how do you have opinions about and friendships with people who are much younger than you, without sounding like a wise old lady in the corner, like a crow?
I mean, I think you just don't. I hear that entirely.
You just don't. You don't talk to anybody under the age of 30.
No, you just don't recite your resume.
Mm.
It's kind of that simple. And you have an open mind.
I just did
that.
I just told you about Mirabella.
But yeah. And I was about to be like, and I worked at Talk. You know what I mean? Like,
oh, it's
like,
hold up. There you go.
You know, like, yeah,
it's
you have
fun. An open mind. Yes. But I guess I feel like I sometimes worry about the balance of experience where I want it to be useful for myself, for other people. I want to be happier in the world because of it and more full in the world because of it. The same way you want to be well read, but how do I not bludgeon people with it?
I think it's the same as any way of not being an
asshole.
Don't be a jerk. Right?
Yeah, I think
it's the same way as not being an asshole. It's just not having an idea that the time you lived in was better than the time that's happening now.
Which is actually a lot. There's a lot of that in the book too about nostalgia. And I think Russell had that idea to like a poisonous degree. And I struggle against having that idea. I mean, the problem is that as someone who's a writer, who works in media, who sees people being laid off, things folding, opportunities shutting, attention spans decreasing, it does feel – it's hard to remember that people thought about that, you know, with the advent of the television. it's hard to not feel nostalgic for it when there's really concrete repercussions, like people losing their livelihoods. I don't know. I worry about, like, irrelevance sometimes, but not really, because I think, what am I going to do? Do you know, pack it up?
Right. Exactly. I mean, I guess that's sort of a, that's sort of like where I want to land this. What do you still want to do?
Oh, after this?
Like, what do you still, after this, what's your next
thing? I feel like, well, I have a fiction.
Okay. I have a yarn
I would like to spin. I have a fiction. but I have a couple of ideas that are like they're still sort of in their zygote stage, so I can't really, you know. Okay. But I do feel like there's a great joy in being comfortable enough to, you know, after the first, like, this is my sixth book, my seventh if you count one I really stupid one I wrote under a pseudonym, but like it's my sixth book, and it's like I'm really gonna do this. But it took that long to be like, yep, this is who I am and it's what I'm going to do. I don't think it's the only thing I'll ever do.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm not going to stray too far sort of away from it. It's not like I'm now going to whittle things. I have no whittling skills. But I feel like I've, you know, thinking about movies and television, theater, things like that.
Yeah. So you have a lot of creative aspirations.
It's
like,
so.
But it seems like you're taking them one at a time. It's not like you're like, and I'm gonna write.
No, well, because I've never really wanted for the same reason I don't have a tattoo, because I feel like I usually do it one at a time. I've never been like, I'm in the mood for a tattoo and then fill in the image. You know, it's more like it's as it comes. And I guess the assurance is more just something else will come. But it's scary. There's always this time period, honestly, this time period right now when promoting a book and you're talking about something that existed in the past, that's still, you know, freshly in the past, still means a lot to you, hopefully, you know, will for some time. And it's like, what if I never think of anything again? But I think it's healthy. I thought about that every essay I've ever finished. I've written, you know, I don't know, 100 and something essays that aren't in the books. And every time I'm done with one, I'm like, well, that was fun. It was a real, real career there for a minute.
That was the last good idea.
Well, because sometimes it feels like your whole, I mean, you know what it's like where people ask you questions, especially like at this age in an interview where they, in this delightful way, apply so much purpose and such a straight line to your past. And for me, it's always been funny because, you know, questions about, oh, what would you recommend if someone wanted to publish a book, stuff like that. And I'm like, the way I got published is insane. I worked basically as like a sort of handmaid for a bunch of different authors. Well, not handmaid in the, you know, in the Atwoodian sense, but for a bunch of different, Margaret Atwood, funny, but like for a bunch of different authors. And then sent an email to a friend of mine who worked at the Village Voice about an experience I had had. And he's like, yeah, I'll turn this into an essay and I'll publish it. I then started writing for the Village Voice, then the Observer, and then I got my first book of essays. But like all of that, the idea of recommending to somebody, oh,
do you want to become a writer? You should definitely work on a bunch of different authors' tour schedules on the off chance that you start emailing someone at the Village Voice about, you know, work-related item. I mean, it's just, it's all this mess and people assume so much purpose to it. And I think what I've learned from that is that feeling I have of, oh, I don't know what I'm going to do next doesn't mean there will not be a next and it's okay and be comfortable not knowing. So yeah, I have some projects in the works, but they're all like a big shrug emoji.
I think that's the best way to do it because, you know, everyone, you just never know how people are. And it's also, it has to be for you because you don't know how people are going to receive it. You don't know anything. And the prescriptive guides are, I had that same feeling because I wrote a self-help book and like, I would be out promoting it and I would be like, oh, my story doesn't apply to anybody here. This is bullshit. This should not be prescriptive. Like, I can't tell you how to do this. I can tell you some,
but it's still
aphorisms,
works though, right? People got a lot out of it. It still works.
Yeah, I still get emails from people that it, like, you know, it helped them. But I had some guilt around it because I was like, I don't know if this is transferable, and I don't know if that's fair. You know, so then I had.
What do you think the people like? Even the people who give, let's take it to the sort of highest level of this kind of thing. Even the people who are giving TED Talks, what do you think they know that you don't? I mean, yes, if it's like a Star Perel, you know.
Yes,
but
yes.
Otherwise that, I mean, who has a literal degree, you know?
Yes.
But barring that, it's the specificity that people attach to.
Totally.
You know, the generalizations, they don't. And I mean, at least I hope that's true because Russell was a very specific person. I told a very specific story. There's no coda at the end of this that says, you know, a little box, let's say, laid out on the book that's like, should this happen to you? You know, for what this is a book only for people who have been burglarized and then their dear friends die of suicide a month later. Frankly, it's a shitty marketing plan. Do you know what I mean? It's like I need to pay rent. It's not going to make me any money. So it's like so hopefully that specificity comes out the other side, you know, and Judge, it did with you too.
It's just you're always grappling with something and you just hope that somebody sees their reflection in it. That's all.
They will. That's it. I mean, they will. And it's just so far it's been actually kind of really moving what people have seen that I'm surprised by. Death that's not suicide that I've gotten letters about. A lot of letters or emails about people who have had loved ones die by suicide, but also people who have been like divorced. People who are terribly homesick or in a foreign country. Like, it's really any sort of grief that you feel, that real profound missing.
Grief in its many, many, many forms.
Many forms.
Many
yeah,
forms.
It's really lovely to touch people like that. It's really lovely to touch people accidentally. Can that be the last thing I say?
That could be that. Well, listen, I wish you all the best, all the good things on this book tour.
And
seriously,
thank you for saying such wonderful things about the book. I mean, it's really, it's actually, I mean, I know this is being recorded. It actually comes out next week. It hasn't come out quite yet. So I don't actually have like this deluge of feedback yet. So thank you.
You're so welcome. And as everyone knows, listen to this podcast, I wouldn't say if it wasn't true because I'm so, so where can people find you? Where can they find you and your work?
Yeah, well, SloaneCrosley.com is a pretty good resource for all things about Bradley Cooper. No, they're all about, that'd be really funny.
That like, would just be the best.
It's a Bradley like, Cooper tribute page.
Oh my God. I wouldn't
even do that.
I know, but it would be
fun. But yeah,
fun.
SloaneCrosley.com. And the book is available for pre-order now on Bookshop. It's available everywhere. I'm also going on tour. I'll be in LA. I don't have the tour dates off the top of my head, but you know where they are? They're on SloaneCrosley.com.
SloaneCrosley.com. Go to that and find Sloane and go to one of Sloane's events. That would be amazing.
Yeah, I'm being joined by, I mean, it's, I'm really lucky. I have a lot
yeah,
of
you
good,
have an all-star lineup.
All-star
it looks
lineup.
Fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm intimidated by them, actually. I'm like, you guys should not be asking me questions. This is actually ludicrous. But
well, it's okay. Better that way than the other way around. It's better them asking you questions than you having to be like, hello, Susan Orlean.
Yeah, Susan is in. Yes. That's a little bit, but it is sort of a little, it's weird to put people you really respect in a position of having to ask you questions or doing work, which is just
forcing them to read your book.
But that's honestly what all book publishing is, or anyone who's ever had anything out. It's like, it's such a strange thing. You write these letters to people basically saying, whether it's a blurb or to do an event or whatever you want from them, the idea of saying, I'm such a big fan. Let me show you how big a fan I am by asking you to do something for me for free.
It's the worst.
So terrible. Such a terrible dynamic.
It is a terrible practice. You're just like, oh, please, please, you know, but also sorry to take up like five of your days.
Seriously, it's a real, but I mean, I guess it's being a good citizen, but it's still, I don't know, I have such empathy for it when people do it to me. I can't imagine what someone like, you know, I mean, it's like Curtis Sittenfeld and Sigrid Nunez in New York. I'm like, what have I done? But yeah. I am, that's not false modesty. I am really nervous, but also like really thrilled.
So it's a great book. It's a good time. It's a great book. It's a good time.
Thank you.
It's a good time for it to come out.
Yeah, it's weirdly, it's like, oh yeah, but I thought it was a good timing. Yeah. I was like, it is a good time. It's a weirdly funny book, but yes, it's a good time in the world.
Yeah, it is. It's a good time to reflect on grief and where we've been. Thank you, Sloane Crosley.
Thank you.
Crosley.
Good to see Crosley.
Sloane Crosley. All right, good to see you too.
Good to see you.
Thanks for listening to Everything is Fine, everyone. If you like the show, please rate and review it on the platforms, especially Apple Podcasts. It really helps people find the show and it makes a difference. If you want to support the production of the show, I keep meaning to say this at the beginning of the episode, you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/everythingisfine. It's $3 is the entry point to join. You can also join as a free subscriber, and sometimes we put up free things there. If you want to follow this show on social media, we have a robust and private Facebook group. That's just on Facebook. Everything is Fine. You'll find it. We're also on Instagram at EIF Podcast. You can find Kim on her Substack, kimfrance.substack.com, Girls of a Certain Age. You can find me at Jen Romolini's Vanity on Instagram and some other places. You can pre-order my book, Ambition Monster is the name of the book. It's in the show notes where you can pre-order my book if you want to. The show is mixed and edited by the wonderful, amazing Natalie Rivera. Natalie, thank you. And we'll be back next week.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.